Genesis 25 is where we are, and we'll be in really just verses 1 to 18. And we get to finish out Abraham's life. And see his legacy, see his death, and then also look at one of his sons, look at his Ishmael's genealogy. So I'll read. Let's start with verses 1 through 11. So I'll read there. Abraham took another wife whose name was Keturah. She bore him Zimram, Jokshan, Medan, Midian, Ishbak, and Shua. Jokshan fathered Sheba and Dedan. The sons of Dedan were Ashuram, Letushim, and Lumim. The sons of Midian were Ephah, Epher, Hanok, Abida, and Elda. All these were the children of Keturah. Abraham gave all he had to Isaac, but to the sons of his concubines, Abraham gave gifts. And while he was still living, he sent them away from his son Isaac, eastward to the east country. These are the days of the years of Abraham's life, 175 years. Abraham breathed his last and died in a good old age, an old man and full of years, and was gathered to his people. Isaac and Ishmael, his sons, buried him in the cave of Machpelah, in the field of Ephron, the son of Zohar the Hittite, east of Mamre, the field that Abraham purchased from the Hittites. There Abraham was buried with Sarah, his wife. After the death of Abraham, God blessed Isaac, his son, and Isaac settled at Beer Lahai Roy. All right, so what observations do you make? What questions do you have?
Why did he get married again?
Why did he get married again? Good question.
Get another thing.
Well, it doesn't really say why he got married again. But you do see the outcome of his marriage, right? Whole bunch of sons. Mm-hmm. And why would that be important? Why would it be important for Abraham to have a lot more sons?
I don't know.
You know? Does anybody know?
Important for him to have more sons?
Yeah, why? Yeah, what would be the significance of it?
Stars of heaven and
number. Yeah, good, yeah. Yeah. He had many descendants, right?
Okay.
Okay,
cool.
And specifically, what do we learn about these? Well, we don't really learn this here. We'll get into it as we get into it. Some of them we'll get into, but these, are there any sons' names that you recognize from later on in the Bible?
Midian.
Yeah, Midian. Good. And what do you know about Midian?
Moses' father-in-law was the priest of Midian.
Good. So it doesn't just stop with Midian, right? It continues. And you actually have the sons of Midian, right? And so Midian becomes a clan, a family clan, a tribe, a nation, right? And so one of the things that Abraham has promised is that he'll be the father of many nations. And so that's in Genesis 17:5-7. So it's not just Isaac and it's not just Ishmael, but it's all these others that are included in that. So that would be the significance of being married after Sarah has died, and then also having sons specifically from that marriage. Now, I have a question for you all. When did Keturah come on the scene? We don't know. Which opens up the possibility that Abraham was married to Keturah before Sarah died.
As one of the concubines?
Good. Where do you see that in verse 6?
Well, I mean, that's in there. But I
Yeah, good. What's a concubine?
A wife almost status.
a wife of lower status, which to us Americans, that sounds really bad. So let's get out of our American culture. And what do I'm curious to know what you all know about concubines.
So Ryan and I just got through studying.
Excellent. Thank you for talking, Jesslyn. I am so happy that you are doing this. Good. Sorry, I've been engaged in what they've been doing, so I'm glad you're doing this.
We had a lot of questions. We texted Noah. Noah gave us some background. But we were looking up like what a concubine was, a wife of lower status, and they actually weren't able to, like, the husband could not divorce a concubine, and they had all the legal protections. You just didn't get, like, the status of having your sons inherit. So you got all the protections, and you couldn't even be divorced, so he couldn't get rid of you. He had to support mm-hmm. you. So it wasn't actually, like, a bad deal. That sounds bad.
It wasn't as bad as it could have been. Yeah. So, yeah, that's a great summary, that they have full legal protection, couldn't be divorced. The issue of concubines later on in the Bible, specifically in the law, is that there's not much said about concubines, and that's because what the law focuses on are wives that have full rights, meaning that their sons would have a full inheritance. There's a law that outlaws, that forbids choosing which son gets the full inheritance based on the husband's relationship with the wife. So the Rachel and Leah, who was the loved one?
Rachel,
right? And so, hey, that's in part why Joseph gets the blessing that he does when there were four sons, four or five sons from Leah before Joseph came along, right? So that's actually forbidden in the law, that there would be this choice, seemingly arbitrary choice amongst the sons.
So was Esther a concubine to the king?
No, Esther was a full wife. She was queen.
Yeah, she was a full wife.
Yeah. Right. Now the rest of the women who were
concubines.
Yeah, they would be part of the harem.
Once you became a concubine, that was for life.
Yep. Now the obviously the it goes back to what are the alternatives for women then. If you're not in the king's harem, then you're not provided for, you're not protected, things like that. Now there are obviously drawbacks, but just speaking economically, it was a really good situation for a woman to be in, just speaking economically. But speaking theologically, what would be the problem? What's the problem with concubines? What's the problem with polygamy? What's the problem?
The definition of marriage is one man and one.
Right. And where do we get?
Eve.
Yes, good. From Genesis 2. So one flesh union between one man and one woman, that's God's design for marriage. Now, pragmatically, practically, whenever we look at in the Bible at the examples of polygamy or concubines, do we have any good examples of, like, man, this is a solid family, even though there's multiple wives? No. Abraham, yeah, I mean, but we don't get a whole lot of a glimpse into this. Right.
Poor Hagar. She got mistreated and
then
cast out.
But yeah, Hagar did deserve some of her mistreatment, though, in how she looked at Sarah and stuff. Anyway.
But Rachel didn't trust, and neither did he. And so it's not a good example.
Jacob and Rachel?
No, I'm sorry. Ishmael, Sarah. Those ones.
Yeah, you're right. Yeah. So it's not a good example,
right?
And not completely Hagar's fault.
Got a bunch of sons.
Now, something that's going for Keturah is that she's still around after Sarah dies. Hagar is not. So at some point, it does become monogamous.
It does say that Isaac and Ishmael buried him together.
I know, it's interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
That's interesting.
Monogamous is a weird word when he has concubines.
Yeah.
Well, the other concubine would be Hagar.
But he has other concubines.
Right.
But the sons of his
concubines. Yeah, so they're not named. We have two names of concubines. So that would be, two would be plural. And so that's, so I, to speculate that he had more, why not name them?
But why, okay. But he gave gifts while he was still living to them and sent them away.
Right. So these sons from Keturah. Keturah is one concubine. Hagar is the other. So this implies that that Ishmael gets a gift when he's sent away. So.
That part initially really bothered me. It's like you have all these kids and you're just going to send them away with just a gift. Mm-hmm. Then I looked it up and it was like, it was enough money to live on basically. It wasn't just like a gift.
Yeah, it's a for life type of, it's a, so these sons, they become trust fund kids. I mean, they're set up because that's how wealthy Abraham was. But that also, sending them away does what for Isaac? Guarantees that he's the heir. There's no question. There's no issue of who the heir is. Now, one generation later, when we get to Jacob and Esau, there is a struggle about inheritance, right? And Jacob's actually the one who gets sent away.
Your original question about why was it important that he have more sons through this concubine doesn't match up with Scripture. Because he's still disobeying what God commanded. And so God could have done whatever, you know, he could have raised descendants other ways. It doesn't give him an out.
Yeah. But you're also saying that God commanded this somewhere.
God commanded what?
That God commanded it somewhere before. Because it only says that it's only going off a precedent. There's no command for one man, one woman. It's only on precedent. That, as far as like a command goes. There's no command. There's only...
At this time.
At this time.
Right.
Yeah. So... Cultural, yeah, I know. I mean, I don't feel comfortable saying that, but I'm just saying that you read it in Genesis 2, and there's not a command there. It's just that this is the principle, this is the precedent. Every other place that we see that there's polygamy going on, it doesn't go well. It usually doesn't end well. There's a whole lot of strife. But it was a cultural practice. It was accepted. And God did, I mean, so you're right, God could have done it some other way, but he did it, but he did do it this way. So whether God approves of it, the outcome of it was blessing, which is what we've seen from Abraham's life this entire time, right? That it almost doesn't matter what he does. God is going to bless Abraham. And that's what happens even to the end of his life. So, by the way, the answer that I was looking for a polygamous marriage that's maybe the best case scenario would be Elkanah with Penaniah and Hannah. But I only say that because it wasn't Elkanah's fault that Penaniah was a bad woman. So it was still, but that, like, when that's like your best example, that what I'm saying is like, this is not good, right? It's not a good thing to do. Also, with what God commands to the king, so a king of Israel in Deuteronomy 17 is not allowed to multiply what?
Wives.
Yeah, gold, gals, and giddy up. Yeah, the gals, the wives. I mean, So even what God says about marriage in the law, there is some allowance for more than one wife in the law, but there's also a forbidding of multiplying like the nations do. So all of this to say, it's very uncomfortable to talk about this and none of this is actually saying, hey, so polygamy is something that we should pursue today. Just because the Bible describes something that happens does not mean that it is prescribed, right? And that's kind of where we, I think we struggle and we forget that principle, that the Bible shouldn't even describe it. And if it does describe it, by describe, I mean say that it happened, we should think like, hey, the next verse, or maybe in parentheses, it should say, and he shouldn't have done this, you know. It leaves it up to later revelation to clarify things about
where... The divorce says that.
What's that?
Divorce that we studied Wednesday night. Because they said, well, Moses gave us permission right, divorce. Yeah. And he said, yeah. Yes, but that's not how it was in the beginning.
Right, not how it was in the beginning. And the reason you have divorce is because of your hardness of heart. It's not because this is a great thing.
Right.
Yeah.
But the original...
Yeah.
It wasn't like that in the beginning. Right.
Yeah.
And most of the Old Testament is to show the need for a Savior. Mm-hmm. I mean, I mean, it's
yep.
Sin after sin after disobedience mm-hmm. after disobedience. So
yep.
Even your best guys are not so great.
They are not. No. So yeah. Some of these, guys, maybe a lot of these guys, you wouldn't want to have over for dinner.
It's still amazing to me that Jacob is Israel. You know what I'm saying? Like, I mean, it's amazing that God chooses,
yep.
you know, Jacob.
Yeah, Jacob. Yeah, Jacob. I loved. Esau, I hated.
To be the 12 tribes. Yep. It's just.
And then you get one generation later with Judah. Like, how does Judah's son come along? Tamar.
Yeah.
Tamar, who dresses up like a prostitute because she knows that Judah will come that way. She knows something about Judah. And he sleeps with her and then she conceives. And that's how Perez comes. And guess who? What?
The line of Christ.
Yep, exactly. Exactly. And Tamar's name gets in the genealogy. In Matthew, right? So
and Perez,
and yeah, it's the long line of godly men and women actually doesn't stretch too far, except to say, God bless them. God bless them. Why? Because he did, not because they deserved it, but because he did. Okay. Anything else you want to talk about with concubines here? Since we're on the topic. We're not going to talk about this again until concubines comes up. So I'm more than willing to not say anything else more about it.
Well, I know when my dad went to the mission field, he couldn't find elders. Because all the Muslims had four wives.
Right, yeah.
So they would come to know the Lord. He followed Timothy and Titus. And
yeah.
That was a big problem in the early years.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
What's the point of the concubine?
It shows what wealth. It shows status. In the culture, in the society, social status. From the woman's point of view, as far as her perspective, it guarantees that she will be provided for and protected throughout her life. So there's economic benefit to it. So a lot of pragmatic stuff, but not necessarily holy and godly stuff. So. Okay. So yeah, I think the main takeaway with this is just remember it, just because the Bible describes it does not mean that God condones it. All right. Just remember that, or that it prescribes it. So, okay, what else? That's it. No more questions about concubines. We're done. I'm kidding.
What's the East Country?
To the East Country. Good. So, remember where Abraham and where Abraham and Isaac are. So when the let's see, when Good, yeah, here it is. So, oops. When the servant comes back with Rebekah, he goes all the way down to Beer Lahai Roy and into the Negev. So this is the southern part of the Promised Land, the southern part of Israel, getting closer into the Sinai Peninsula. And if you remember your geography of the Middle East, what is to the east?
Jordan.
Yeah, Jordan, and then you keep going. What do you have after that? You have Saudi Arabia, you have the Arabian Desert. And, well, no, just in the Arabian Peninsula. Yeah, so not very far. So sending them to the east sends them away from the Promised Land, gets them out of the Promised Land, and that's where these tribes actually end up. They end up in the northwest part of the Arabian Peninsula, on the other side of the Gulf of Aqaba. And some of them do migrate. You find them, or at least names that are similar, going more north toward Assyria, toward Babylon. But so sending them to the east is to get them out of the Promised Land. But another reason would be where are people sent when they're sent out, when they're sent away? Like Adam and Eve are sent which direction?
East.
Where's Cain sent? East.
East.
Right? And so there's this, whenever, now, obviously geographically, you can't send them to the west because then you're sending them into the sea, right? And so, I mean, geographically, it makes sense, but theologically, and as far as being sent out to the east, that's where you're going away from God's blessing. Which in this case, that's not saying anything bad about the children, like they sinned somehow or whatever. It's to say, look at where Isaac is. He doesn't get sent out. He stays. And Abraham actually forbids that he would ever leave, right? Because this is the place of blessing. This is the place of God's blessing. And he receives God's blessing. At the end of the passage, Abraham, after the death of Abraham, God blessed Isaac, his son, right? So guarantees that Isaac is the unquestioned heir of Abraham and his Abraham's stuff, his estate, and more importantly, his blessing. And that is physically pictured in him staying in the land, which will be a big reason why Jacob leaving is going to be dramatic. So just to point that forward. So yeah, good question. Does that answer it for you, Nancy?
Yeah.
Okay. Any other questions or observations that you see? Okay, so let's look at Abraham's legacy here. So this would be, his legacy. So Abraham took another wife. Her name was Keturah. This name has something to do with burning incense and or spices and things like that, which is, it's interesting that when we come across the Midianites here in about 12 or 13 chapters, when Joseph is sold into slavery, he's sold into slavery to Ishmaelites, who are also known as Midianites, so there might be some crossing over there, some intermarriage already going on there between the two, but they're traveling to Egypt to sell spices. And so maybe there's a link here. It's interesting, to say the least, that her name kind of points to something that her sons will be involved in, or many of her sons will be involved in. Okay, so what we end up having here is about 16 names. There are three generations that this goes into. So Keturah bears these sons: Zimram, Jokshan, Medan, Midian, Ishbak, and Shua. Some of them, their names come up later, but the focus in verse 3 becomes Jokshan. So these are Sheba and Dedan are Abraham's grandsons. And then you have the sons of Dedan, Dedan are Ashurim, Letushim, and Lumim. So this goes into that third generation, fourth generation if you count Abraham. And what this is saying is like, when it's a reflection of what we see later on in Proverbs and Psalms and some of the wisdom literature, that when you're able to see and you're able to name, I'm not sure if Abraham saw his great-grandchildren, but to have this line extended out, it's a demonstration of God's blessing. And so you're seeing that in Abraham's, at the end of Abraham's life, his children are having children who are having children. And so it's just the faithfulness of God, the blessing of God on Abraham. And so I won't belabor the point as far as all the where all of these names are coming from or where we see them later on, but we'll just say that they're more most of the names make later appearances in the Bible. Now some of them they may be we may get them confused with others. So like Sheba is actually not, remember the Queen of Sheba? There's actually not a link there because Abraham comes from, now we have to go back to Noah's line. So Shem, Ham, and Japheth, right? So there's a Sheba that comes from Ham's line. And now we see that there's a Sheba that comes from Abraham's line. Who's from which of Noah's sons? If you're anti-Semitic, then who are you against? The Jews. Where do you think Semitic comes from? Shem, yeah. Okay, so that's kind of where that word comes from. Which actually makes it ironic that Muslims who trace themselves back to Ishmael, who's Abraham's son, anti-Semitic. Anyway, don't need to go that far, that direction anymore. Just something that popped in my head and probably should have just stayed there. So all these are the children of Keturah. So again, it goes three generations deep. And then we find out what does Abraham do with all of these sons and what implications does that have for Isaac? Abraham gave all that he had to Isaac. So this is the estate. That means that he is he's the heir. And that's in contrast, but to the sons of his concubines, and this would be of those that are named, again, there may be more, but they're not named, so it's pointless to speculate. We have Hagar, and we have Keturah. To the sons of his concubines, Abraham gave gifts, and that's like Jesselyn said, that sets them up for life. And while he was still living, he sent them away from his son Isaac, eastward to the east country. Why is it significant that while Abraham is still living, he gives these gifts and he sends them away?
Make it clear who the heir was.
Yes, yes. And it's the owner of the estate or how who's Abraham when it comes to like an estate? When the man, the father, he designates one particular son, but he's the one who's responsible for saying who the heir is and then who's not the heirs and then making that crystal clear by saying one thing, one son gets the estate, these other sons get the gifts. And then those other sons get sent away. When it's Abraham doing that, it makes it crystal clear, geographically clear, who the heir is so that there's no strife, there's no question, there's no family civil war going on about who the heir is.
Yeah. You want to accomplish that before he died.
Yeah, yeah.
And God allowed him to live long enough so that those sons were old enough to be able to,
yeah,
to do that.
Yeah. Good, yeah. So this is key. And why is this key? Why does this need to be said? Why do we need to know this, especially specifically about Isaac?
He carries the promises.
He carries the promises. He has been named. He has been named by God. Abraham has put everything on him as well. Specifically in chapter 24, Abraham sends his servant in order to get a wife for his son Isaac. He doesn't do that for anybody else, it would seem. But it specifically, he is sent out to get a wife for his son. And so everything rides on Isaac, and everything that Abraham does makes that clear. The last thing to say about this is that how long does Abraham believe the promise? Don't worry about the extent of time, but does he falter in his faith in the promise? No. So not just when, hey, Isaac is born. Hey, Isaac is weaned. Hey, we're good. He ensures it all the way to the end, right? All the way to the end of his life. So he endures in his faith.
But isn't this kind of a repeat of Hagar? I mean, he's been through this where he had to send her and his son away because he was trying to take the promises in his own hand. It wasn't the promise of all the descendants made through Isaac, not through all these other sons.
So being the father of many nations is actually related. So back in Genesis 17, is that what you're talking about?
Yeah.
Or related back to that? That's actually given in response to what Abraham says about Ishmael. You'll be the father of many nations, which would include Ishmael.
Okay.
And so that would extend to these other sons by implication.
Okay. It just seems like, I've been here before. I need to send them away before
but in this case, he's not saying it because he's messed up. He's actually ensuring, and he's the one who's in charge. He's not being told, because remember, when he sends Hagar and Ishmael away, Sarah has to be the one to tell him.
Right.
And Sarah's actually doing that by faith. Yeah, right. And so Abraham does not need his wife at this point, does not need Sarah to do this, to remind him, hey, like, Isaac's the guy. He believes it, and so he acts on that, acts according to it.
Okay.
Yeah.
His faith had really been sanctified, hadn't it?
Yeah.
You know, like what we were talking about.
So right.
I mean, really.
Yeah, absolutely. Good.
So Abraham didn't send these other sons away while they were still young, did he? Because he lived to be 175 years old.
Probably not, especially if Keturah was around before, as a concubine before Sarah's death. Then, because Sarah dies when Abraham is about 130 something, and so there's another 40 years. So even if Keturah comes after Sarah has died, then these kids are the oldest would be 40 something, and making the youngest in their 20s probably. So. That's a good, good question. Good observation. Okay, so now, looking at his death. So this is the death of Abraham in verses 7-11. All right, these are the days of the years of Abraham's life, 175 years. Abraham breathed his last and died in a good old age, an old man full of years, and was gathered to his people. So before we get to the burial, what do you see here? That's a long time, right? And how is that described? When he breathes his last, he dies in a good old age. An old man, full of years. Yeah, satisfied. Good. Good, yeah. something that the 170, so just a couple of notes just to give us perspective. When does Abraham come to the land initially? When is he first called?
He's
75. So he's been in the land, or he's been walking with the Lord for a century, right? So, and you think like, man, it took the Lord that long to work on Abraham. Like, okay. That's
Abraham that long to figure it out.
It took Abraham that long to figure it out. Right. So what do we learn about, Laura, you brought this up just now, the sanctification. What do we learn about that from this?
It's lifetime and God's patience.
Yeah. God is patient to continue working on us, and it's throughout our life. So we don't reach an end point in our sanctification. Mm-hmm. We keep pressing forward.
What do you suppose that means, satisfied with the life? Exactly.
Where's the satisfied with life?
Good age.
Oh, the good old age?
Satisfied with life.
Really? Yours says satisfied with life?
That's what
I think full of years.
It
is
says
that
satisfied with life.
Oh, full of years?
I think full of years, because that's where it shows up. And that's NAS has satisfied with life.
Yeah. NAS has satisfied with life as the implied words that are in Ital. So satisfied is the word.
Where does that come?
Satisfied is where?
Satisfied and then with life. After the old man.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, okay. So, yeah. So it would come from this word full. So ESV has full. Mm-hmm. And so full, it's also the word that when you're filled up after eating, you're satisfied with that food. So the translating it as satisfied with life, meaning that it's a full life. So, not necessarily the way that I would translate it, though. But his year, so with it coming out after a good old age, what does that mean? So both of these are coming, an old man and full of years, it's describing further this good old age. What does it look like to be a man of good old age? You're an old man, you're full of years, or satisfied with life. Maybe that's maybe a little bit more too positive to say about it.
Aaron, what does LSV have? You got that? Same thing?
It says full of days.
Of days being in
accounts. Full of days.
Yeah. So he's an old man and full. Which
so like completion?
Yeah. Yeah. Now, it probably helps here to remember something from Genesis 15. So in Genesis 15, verse 15, God says something about about Abraham's descendants. What's going to happen to Abraham's descendants? Where are they going to end up going? To Egypt, right?
Yep.
Into slavery. They're going to be there for 430 years. But for you, Abraham, what's going to happen for you? You're going to be buried at a good old age. And so this being an old man full of years or full of life, satisfied, it's just a way to say he ended his life well. I think that's a good way to summarize it. He ended his life well. Danny, you agree with that?
Yeah. I think so.
Okay.
I thought maybe there was an original word that was different.
Yeah, no, it's just...
But
like having a full tummy, you're just
age,
ripe old age. Well, you know, ripe, you're ready to be picked, right?
Ready to be picked. But as 15 says, back in Genesis 15, it says, to your fathers in peace, you shall go to your fathers in
right.
peace.
Yeah.
You know, yeah.
So verse 8 is really saying what God promised to Abraham in Genesis 15 is fulfilled. So he's fulfilled the promise about this son, Isaac. He's fulfilled the promise about this. I mean, he's put a down payment basically on the land, or at least Abraham's made a statement of faith about the land with the burial place, which is what comes up in verse 9, that you have these, the way that Abraham dies becomes like this promissory note to say, God's going to do the rest of it. Just look at Isaac, look at his life, look at Abraham's life, look at the way that it ended. God's going to be faithful. He's been faithful.
So you can look at it as if, I mean, God, he's fulfilled the promises that God had told him, and he did his part, even though he did it with a lot of sin.
Yes, yes, yeah. Yeah. So,
and when you think of satisfied, what it just objected to me that I'm not satisfied with my life because of the sin that's there, but but I am satisfied that he's continuing working.
Right, yeah, yeah. And I think that if Abraham's looking, so Abraham's living before the law, he's living before all of this revelation that even goes down to like anger, you know, Jesus saying that, I tell you that if you're angry with your brother, you call him fool, you call him moron, you know, that does add a burden that Abraham didn't necessarily have. That revelation wasn't given to him. And so, not to say that he's self-justifying or anything like that, he can still look back on failures, but I think that what we all want with life, with a long life, is to be able to look back and see God's faithfulness in our lives. And we will see that. And Danny, I think what you're getting after is really kind of a discontent holy life, like pursuing sanctification, pursuing righteousness, and it's not there yet. You're not there yet, and that actually is honoring to God because that's what he deserves. So we should strive after holiness and be discontent with what we've done already, but not look at it in only one way, be able to look back and say, look at how God has been faithful in my life. Yeah.
Philippians.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. All right.
I'm glad we don't live to 175.
Yep, yep.
It's a long time to
say. It is a long time. And this actually comes after the flood, the lifetimes start getting shorter. It's interesting when Jacob dies when he's like 140 something. Does anybody remember off the top of their head?
Seems like about that.
So he says to Pharaoh, like Pharaoh sees him, like, man, you are old. And Jacob's like, the years of my sojourning have been few and difficult. And he's like 140, and it's like, Jacob, you are so dramatic. But when his grandfather was 175 and didn't have to deal with all the things that he dealt with in his life, it's like, all right, we can give him a break. But it's still like, you never cease to amaze us.
You have not aged, bro.
He's gathered to his people. This is something that we see over and over in the Bible, as far as you're joining ancestors in death. That's how it's used later on. But I think that here there's a precedent that's being set. Like, who are Abraham's people? Sure, family would be involved. Obviously, Sarah is would be first on the list. But then you just look back on all the men and women who carried God's promises with them. Obviously, Abraham's, the promise that rests with Abraham is bigger than any of the promises that they had. But to be gathered to his people, be gathered with his faithful people. So this kind of sets a precedent that this is what you want out of death for a believer, for a citizen of Israel. This is what you want out of life, and this is what you want in death. You want to die with your family. You want to be buried with your people, just like your father Abraham was. And then who shows up at his burial? You have Isaac and you have Ishmael. And what are they both called? His sons. I mean, this is a little bit of a reminder of Genesis 21, when Abraham sends Ishmael away, and it's the text actually belabors the point that Ishmael is the last one that Abraham gets to. The man loved Ishmael. He was his firstborn son, right? And so, and where is Ishmael? He's there, and he's with Isaac, whatever, at least for the time being, whatever animosity was there. Remember, the reason why he was sent away is because he was playing sport in some way with Isaac. And that becomes the impetus for Ishmael to be sent away. That animosity, at least for the time being, is gone. Both sons are there to bury him, and he gets buried in the cave of Machpelah. This comes up in Genesis 23. And that's where Abraham purchases the field along with the cave, and that's where Sarah is buried. And that's what we're given all the way through verse 10. Field that Abraham purchased from the Hittites. There Abraham was buried with Sarah, his wife. So you have his sons, his wife. I think this is building on that good old age, full life type of thing, full of years. And who's with him in death? His sons are, Isaac and Ishmael, and then his wife is obviously there too, the body of his wife. And so this, I mean, hopefully this doesn't sound bad or crass or anything like that, but remember when Abraham buys the field, he's making a statement of faith that this is where my descendants belong. This is where we belong. This is where my family belongs, in the land, and I'm willing to pay any price. And he pays that exorbitant price, right? Faith. This would be maybe the crass statement. Faith pays off in the end. Like, there's blessing in the end. You know, if he buckles during the negotiations back in Genesis 23, he doesn't get this moment. And so being steadfast in faith, being willing to sacrifice because of your trust in God, it pays off in the end. We get to see that with Abraham and be spurred on toward that in our own lives. After the death of Abraham, God blessed Isaac, his son, and Isaac settled at Beer Lahai Roy. This would be the well that actually comes up in Genesis 16, and it's also where he is in chapter 24. The main point here is that he's in the land. Isaac is in the land. And where he's settling, and that sets us up for Isaac's life that will be the focus of things after this genealogy. But before we leave this in verse 11, after the death of Abraham, God blessed Isaac, his son. Why put it that way? Why is that so significant? Why is that important?
Blessing carries on. The promise carries on.
Yeah, promise carries on. What God promised to Abraham does not die with Abraham, right? And that's after the death of Abraham, God blessed Isaac, his son, and even the way that it's put, Abraham's son, right? That this is a way to capture, just in a few words, look at God's faithfulness. Abraham didn't die childless. He died in the land, and what God promised to him, he fulfilled. Especially in this case with a son, and that blessing that's upon Abraham is now upon Isaac. And that's going to play a major role in the rest of the book. Who is the one who carries forward the blessing of Abraham? So any questions on this before we get into the genealogy? All right, God's faithfulness and Abraham's faith really is the point there. And then we have this, the genealogy of Ishmael. So does anybody, it's been a while since we've been in a genealogy. Does anybody remember why in Genesis, why these genealogies are important?
Our Savior's genealogy is traced back to
good, Jesus. But Ishmael's not part of that, right?
No, it's Isaac. It's not right. Ishmael. It's through Abraham.
So, yeah, why take the time to give Ishmael a genealogy?
Because God promised Abraham.
Good, yeah.
Ishmael would have
12,
right?
Yeah, well, I don't remember if there was a number, but there would be princes and rulers would come from him. Mm-hmm. But yes, and that so that's made that promise is actually made to both Hagar and Abraham, right? And so here's a fulfillment of that: is that look at what happens with Ishmael. He expands, his name expands, and that fulfills God's promise. What else with this?
It's good for the historical evidences of, I don't know.
Yeah, definitely history plays a role that these were real people. Mm-hmm.
If you go back to Genesis 17, 20, as for Ishmael, I have heard you. Behold, I will bless him and will make him fruitful and multiply him exceedingly. He shall become the father of 12 princes.
Okay, yeah, okay,
and I
yeah.
will make him a great nation.
Nancy's right,
think
yeah.
It's, I think it's just showing that God followed through with that promise.
Yeah, yeah. Good, good. So God's faithful to Ishmael, but then this is where it ends with Ishmael. Now we do have the Ishmaelites, some sons of Ishmael or descendants of Ishmael who buy Joseph and take him into Egypt later on. And Ishmaelites will continue to make appearances throughout the rest of the Old Testament. So all of those things, yes, and something to remember about Genesis is that the genealogies carry everything forward. It's a way to wrap up a life and to say, okay, now we're moving on. Ishmael doesn't come back into the picture, but let's remember that Ishmael is significant. And so anybody who's anybody gets their genealogy. And so Ishmael gets a genealogy, and then that wraps up the story of his life. And why is he important? Because he's Abraham's son. Right? And so, yeah, the Genesis, what was that? Genesis 17?
20.
Yeah, and that's what Nancy was saying with the 12 princes. And what do we have here? We have 12 names, right? So these are the generations of Ishmael, Abraham's son, whom Hagar, the Egyptian, Sarah's servant, bore to him. So we have this whole background of Genesis 16 there. These are the names of the sons of Ishmael, named in the order of their birth. So this is birth order. Nebaioth, the firstborn of Ishmael, Kedar, Abdiel, Mibsam, Mishma, Duma, Massa, Hadad, Tema, Jetur, Naphish, and Kedemah. These are the sons of Ishmael, and these are their names by their villages and by their encampments, 12 princes according to their tribes. So there's the 12 princes, but then it's also tribes, villages, encampments. So it's not just the sons, but what surrounds the sons, right? So Ishmael is definitely becoming this great nation, this big nation. This is just one generation of descendants, but obviously the further generations are implied by those the following words. if you're curious, villages, these are unwalled. Encampments, these would be mobile. But there's also 12, their princes and their tribes. What do you remember about what God says about Ishmael? That having unwalled villages and having encampments would be, why would that be an important thing?
He would be a wild donkey of a man.
Good, yeah. He's going to be a wanderer. He's going to be a wild donkey man. And his descendants are primarily nomads, and that's what they are for centuries. And in some cases, those who draw their lineage all the way back to Ishmael, they still are. What God says about them ends up being true, being fulfilled. So these are, verse 17, these are the years of the life of Ishmael, 137 years. He only survives Abraham by about 48 years. Isaac is 180 when he dies, and he survives Abraham by about 105 years. So when you compare the two, like who has the blessing just as far as duration of life goes, Isaac does. But then he gets an ending that's similar to Abraham, and this, but it's contracted. It's shorter. He breathed his last and died. He was gathered to his people, so he's not buried in the land. There's no mention of being buried in the land or with Abraham, and so he's important. He's significant because he's attached to Abraham, but he is not like Isaac. And so these are just little ways, minor ways to say Isaac is the guy. Right,
concubine of sons,
bro. Yes, I mean, it depends on who your mom is. Yeah. He's obviously successful in his life.
Doesn't say he's full though.
Doesn't say he's full. Yep. So this is now. Having said that, this is he breathed his last and died and was gathered to his people. That's actually a common way to talk about an important character's death. And then verse 18 gives us the geographical locations where his sons spread out, where his people spread out. They settled from Havilah to Shur, which is opposite Egypt in the direction of Assyria. He settled over against all his kinsmen. So where they settle is basically from into the Sinai Peninsula, And then just kind of wrapping up around on the other side of the Jordan River Valley, in the desert, in the Arabian desert. And so they're kind of in and around Keturah's sons. So there is some mixing and matching that goes on there. But they're, again, outside the land, right? Outside the land, only Isaac is in the land. Obviously, the Canaanites are still there. But as far as Abraham's sons go, they're the only ones in the land, which... When Israel reads this or hears it read on the plains of Moab and says, hey, all of these people who stretch back to Abraham, they're not there. They're not in the land. The land belongs to you. It was promised to you, stretching all the way back to Abraham. And then one last note on Ishmael. He settled over against all his kinsmen. What other translations do you have?
Defiance.
Yeah, and what is
against? Okay,
coming back to Genesis 16, he's the wild donkey of a man. He's going to be against the face of his brothers, in the face of all his brothers. This is he's settled over against, like, this is falling, literally. It's falling in the face of his brothers or his kinsmen. And it's actually a direct quote of Genesis 16:12. So what ends up happening with Ishmael and his descendants is exactly what God said would happen. And what that sets up is that, okay, Ishmael and his people, they're characteristically opposed to other people. So him kind of putting an olive branch out there with Isaac at Abraham's death, that was kind of a one-off. This isn't going to continue. He and his people, his descendants, are characteristically opposed to others. Even those with similar backgrounds, family history, family lineage, opposition there. And that opposition is going to stretch all the way out. And case in point with Joseph. He gets sold into their hands and, like, we can't do this to an extended relative, right? No, we're here to make money. That kind of thing. So that does it for Ishmael, and that does it for our time tonight. Any last words, any last comments?
I was thinking that in regard to saying what you said, Ishmael wasn't really mentioned anymore after that, other than his descendants. Wasn't the same thing true of Cain? I mean, after his genealogy was listed, then there's no more.
Yeah, no more mentioning him. Yeah, we just find out that he settled in the land of wandering, right? Ironic thing. But then after his line is given, there's nothing more about him. But the focus gets put on Adam and then Seth and his line. Yeah. So yeah, the genealogy really is kind of a way to say, okay, we're narratively we're done with this guy. And we're moving on to the next thing. And what's the next thing? You have Isaac actually having children. Like, Isaac having children is not going to be... Sorry, the next thing that happened. There's going to be an issue there. There's going to be a problem. We're not going to get the extended drama like we did with Abraham. Maybe some family drama, but we're not going to get the extended drama. Good. Anything else?
A lot of these descendants of Ishmael and any of them, the descendants of the concubines, they turn out to be antagonistic to Israel.
Some of them. Well, most of them even, yeah. Yep. But not all of them. Like Moses' grandfather, father-in-law,
sure,
is a priest of Midian.
So, if this is being first heard by Israel, they're being given the genealogy of many of Abraham's descendants,
yeah,
who are in fact their enemies.
Yeah, yeah. But then, and I'm glad you brought this up, that when they are going to their staging area to go into the land, there, God specifically tells them, do not attack them because they are your kinsmen. Appeal to them. And both times that they say, hey, we're going to stay on the highway. We'll buy whatever we use. We're not expecting any gifts or we just want safe passage. And they say, no, right? That's their kinsmen. But God still says, you don't go, that's their land. Now, when they come out to attack, then Israel does defeat them. But you have this, Israel's like, they are constantly being mauled, attacked, by their neighbors, and many of their neighbors happen to be also distant relatives.
It's interesting that Abraham, took him 100 years before he'd have a son, and now his Ishmael is very fruitful. Mm-hmm. And then I was reading ahead to the genealogy of Isaac, it's like he was also not fruitful.
Right,
it's
yeah,
a huge
yeah,
struggle
yeah,
to have two
yeah,
in the end.
Yep. But yep.
God's choosing the...
He's choosing a way that forces faith.
Yeah.
Yep. Yep.
Just interesting.
It is interesting. It is interesting. And at the same time, what God says is that many children are a blessing from the Lord. So. Mm-hmm. All right, let's pray.
He chose sinners just like us.
Yeah. Yeah. And let's pray. Father, thank you for this passage and wrapping up Abraham's life. We thank you for your faithfulness to him, that you fulfilled all of your promises, even those that we've forgotten about, Ishmael and being the father of many nations. That you remember them. You remember all your promises, and so we thank you that you are the God who remembers. And we ask that you would strengthen us to live a life that is similar to Abraham, that we would learn from his failures, but also imitate his successes, and especially imitate him in his faith that endured to the end. Make us men and women who trust you and who live by faith. We ask this in Jesus' name. Amen.